Hello, and welcome to the 9th episode of The Ecocentrics. I'm Tom.
And I'm PK, and this week we're going to discuss our consumer habits.
Do we consume too much?
We sure as heck do, but how can we cut back?
I've got some somewhat strong opinions on this, as I'm sure everyone will have already guessed by now.
Oh, and I do too. I could go on and on, and maybe I shall. In last week's episode, we had a voice note from Jordan that suggested we should stop developing new renewable technologies and instead just live a more primitive life, or basically a simpler life. So this week, we thought we'd discuss how to consume less and why this concept is critically important. In this episode, we're going to discuss something called Earth Overshoot Day, which kind of helps us understand how much we're overconsuming. We're going to talk about some other things like planned obsolescence versus the right to repair. And we're going to talk about a circular economy, demand reduction, and a whole bunch of other things.
Let's go.
So, Earth Overshoot Day. Tom, have you heard of it?
Yeah, and it's one of those things that is concerningly getting earlier and earlier in the year each year. But basically, the simple premise of it is that it's the day of the year which we have consumed all of the resources that the Earth can renew in one year. Back in the 70s, it was back in sort of October time. And luckily this year, we managed to use so many of the Earth's resources that we're already in May. On the 13th of May will be Earth Overshoot Day.
Yeah, and that's in the UK. It might be May 15th, but May 13th is close enough. So basically, at the time of this recording, which is early May, first week in May, we just got 1 week to go until in the UK, the average citizen is consuming the rest of the year's ecological resources, essentially. And in other parts of the globe, they're using them faster. So for instance, US is March 13th, but China doesn't hit their Earth Overshoot Day until June 1st. And that is because per capita. So most of China's citizens aren't super wealthy and aren't buying a lot of products. So they per capita actually use less resources than somebody, your average citizen in the UK. So I think how the Earth Overshoot Day is really valuable is it puts it sort of in perspective of how much we're overconsuming. And to give you just a bit of an example, and I'm using US data here. So the US population since 1970, so basically about 53 years, has increased by 60%. Yet in that time frame, consumer spending has increased by 400%. And probably a lot of those people were not actually, as the research shows, psychologically happier because of our overconsumption. Now, I will make a caveat and a note, as Tom and I often do, in that there are certain segments of the population who should be consuming more because they unfairly don't have enough of the resources that they should have. And that's even in our own country as well. However, for many of us, we are buying more things than we need, whether it's clothing. We've talked about food. 8% of our food is wasted. So that's not only just money we're wasting, it is resources and the planetary resources as well.
There's this phrase that gets banded around as a way to solve some of these problems, and that's decoupling. And this is the idea that we can split off emissions growth from growth of our consumption. And in some part, in places like the UK, that has occurred. We have seen what's called relative decoupling. So the amount of emissions that come from our consumption or GDP growth have slowed down somewhat compared to the growth rate. However, this doesn't include all of the things that go on overseas. And more importantly than that, because I think this is a really concerning factor, if you look at the material throughput, so all of the materials required to create all the things which we consume, we have been unable historically ever in any circumstance to decouple material throughput from economic growth and consumption. And I think this is one of the fundamental misconceptions there is with this, that actually maybe we need to consume less generally.
Is that because we are so rapacious that there's just no way with the amount of materials that we're using, we could actually as a global system decouple?
I feel like rapacious is jumping to the conclusion that we're inherently bad at what we're doing.
We are, Tom. Tom, we are.
No, we're not. We're not inherently bad. We're forced to do bad things.
We're inherently neutral.
Yeah. I genuinely believe that human beings are inherently good.
Oh, we didn't get cynic Tom today.
I know.
We got optimistic, Tom.
It's one of my fundamental values, which I sometimes find hard to rationalize, but I try to stick with it, that humans are genuinely good. We just do bad things.
Is this like your form of religion?
Yeah.
Human philosophy, according to Tom.
And I know many people would disagree, and a lot of philosophers would disagree, actually, and some would agree. That's a whole other debate, really, in terms of actually what's going on.
That's our next podcast. Ethics and human nature.
I actually think consumption has been something which we've been historically so tied to. Like, it's not a modern conception. I think hyper and overconsumption to the level we're at today is obviously a modern conception. But actually, like, if you go back historically, like the origins of cities were based on the ideas of consumption, and particularly kind of presenting yourself as a consumer.
Mm.
The first cities had wealthy people walking around saying, look at me, look what I've consumed, I've got these gold chains. Like, that was kind of one of the premises of the city state and how it evolved. And I think it's part of human nature in some way. But I think what's happened now is we've kind of expedited what we're doing and said, okay, it's not just a wealthy thing that happens. And I don't think it should be either. But actually, we've just said, okay, let's consume as much as possible. Let's grow our economies as much as possible. And rather than historically in the city state, which I'm talking about, where they overconsumed that led to social collapse, we've got so much innovation and so many things which kind of postpone social collapse that actually we don't necessarily interact with that and try to self-contain those consumption levels.
I think you're right. It's sort of like what's happened with us with food and fast food, having an abundance of access to certain types of calories and certain types of foods, where we've become heavier and heavier and heavier to the point that it impacts our long-term health and our healthcare systems. But it's the same thing that's being done elsewhere with almost everything else, you know, whether it's our houses or our cars or our clothing or tech stuff. We, as a species, resources were much harder and took much more effort to get to clothe ourselves, to create food. And now we have much easier and faster access to a lot of these things. And that's helped society in many ways. But I think the term, when you said hyperconsumption, I think that's hitting it on the nail. It is the hyperconsumption. And then what's sad is that for a whole generation of people being born right now, this isn't hyperconsumption. This is just normal. This is their normal to them. So, for example, in terms of clothing, which is fashion, is a huge player in terms of global waste. So in 2014, we bought 60% more clothing than we did in the year 2000. But for my nephews, who are, you know, literally 18, 19, 20 years old, for them, that's just normal. So it's trying to understand, how do we make an ever-growing population where hyperconsumption is normal? How do we address those issues?
I also think there's a really gendered nature to all of this. And it really, really targets, especially with the fashion industry, women, and says, okay, to fit in, you have to consume all of this stuff.
Mm.
Also, I guess in some sectors as well, men. So if we think about, like, for example, fast cars and having the newest, fastest car, and actually playing on kind of gender stereotypes and reinforcing some of these social norms, it's something that we kind of all know, but we don't necessarily acknowledge and understand actually how damaging that is to people as well.
Oh, absolutely. And same with overconsumption of the beauty industry as well, the massive amounts of money that women end up spending. And women historically make less than men, even if they're doing the exact same job and returning the exact same metrics. They make less than men, but they're also being told, you're not going to be valued enough unless you look like this, unless you dye your hair. But yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's even more than that. There's, I don't know if you remember, Tom, or you may not have been cued into this.
Probably wasn't born.
This was in the UK. And I think this was probably in the last 5 or 7 years. So you might have been a toddler. But there was a pink razor that was sold to women. And then there was the blue razor that was sold to men. And of course, they were kept in different segments of the grocery store, the health and beauty aisle. And they were the identical razor blades, just different colors, but the one for women was sold at a higher price. And then that company was called out. I can't remember what it was. And then they had to lower that price. But could you imagine working at that company? Maybe people didn't even notice it, but somebody might have noticed. and just how wrong that is when you think about it. I think increasingly men are being promoted fashion as well.
I think there's a big picture point that you're connecting this all to, really. Actually, what is the connection between the consumption that we're having and our unhappiness? And there's an absolutely amazing book. I couldn't recommend it enough. I say amazing book. Some people who aren't as dull as me will probably find it dull. But I love the graphs.
Is it? I was about to say, is it the dictionary, Tom?
Well, there's all sorts of words in there you can learn.
So what's this amazing book?
The book I'm going to recommend is called The Spirit Level.
The Spirit Level.
We'll put it in the show notes. And what they do is they look at income versus various factors. And actually what they find is that the important factor in happiness isn't the amount of money we have or the amount of things we're consuming. And actually there's kind of an L-shaped curve. So as we go up to around about $20,000 per capita, people do get happier because it's actually giving life's basic essentials. But beyond that point, the growth of happiness is very, very marginal and slow. So actually, once we get past a certain threshold, there's a very limited increase in our happiness. And actually, what delivers more happiness is when people feel more equal in a society. So they feel like they have the same as their peers around them. And that's actually almost the opposite of this consumption, because it's not saying, oh, the person across the street's got a nice Beamer. It's saying, okay, actually, we have a car that we share together and we're all happy being together. Like, it's a completely different philosophy. And I think it also brings in another question of actually, what do we define as the good life nowadays? And I think a lot of the time, consumption is tied into that.
But I think this links back to, I think it was a study somewhere in the United States that's somewhere around $70,000. At that point, your happiness doesn't increase at all with any more money. So even if you won the lottery and you went from a certain salary and then all of a sudden you have millions, your happiness often decreases in a lot of ways for a variety of reasons. You have people reaching out to you for more money, but you don't know how to manage it. But at the end of the day, if your basic needs are met after about 70,000, at least in the States, it was like you've capped out on your happiness level, because that's enough to get to feed you, to clothe you, to house you, and possibly a few other family members.
One of the underpinning economic philosophies, which is kind of governs a lot of the decisions that are made at the moment, is kind of been proven to be a bit of a fallacy as well. And this is the idea of the environmental Kuznets curve. So basically, it's a U-shaped curve, or to put it scientifically, it's an inverse parabola, which says that actually, as a country's GDP or individual's wealth within a country increases, their environmental impact will increase to a certain point, but then beyond that point, it'll start to decrease. And that's because people move to more efficient processes, moving things like renewable energy at the same time. But actually, we've kind of seen the opposite effect in many ways, where as people's incomes increase, they have a worse environmental impact, as was to be expected. But it doesn't level off and decrease over time as people buy electric cars and heat pumps. Instead, it comes back to a point that we talked about recently. There's a rebound effect. And actually, like when people have a certain amount of wealth, they end up buying really carbon intensive things, like a plane, for example. Like we see all these billionaires saying, I've got a private jet, but I have an electric car, so it's okay. And it's just kind of the juxtaposition which exists there. And actually, the philosophy that underpins our ideas around the environmental impact of our economy is fundamentally flawed. And the economist himself, Kuznets, did say this is a bad idea.
Yeah, the evidence absolutely shows that actually the higher your income is, the more you end up consuming for a variety of reasons, whether you have a bigger house, you have more cars, you have more than one car per person in your house, you buy that jet. You know, I mean, I just had to recently sell mine because I felt so bad about it. But I did buy 17 EVs with it. So, you know,
I just burned all of them straight away.
That's right. Because I can. Yeah. And then there's a correlating human behavior that also happens with that as well, as we have rising incomes. But on top of that, what they've shown is psychologically, your empathy decreases as well for people who are poor. There are so many amazing behavioral studies linked to this, which is unfortunate. You start to get to a point where you go, I deserve this, or I earned this, and start to forget the advantages you had by being born in a specific country or to a specific family, or, you know, having certain links and connections that your family or your community had. You forget about those as well. But there is a particular study in the United States where there's crosswalks. And in California, you have to stop if it looks like somebody's about to get on that crosswalk. What they did was the study, the people with the cheap cars that would be linked to a lower income bracket always stopped to let these people pass. But the higher up in expense and status the car was, the less likely they were to stop to allow this person. And there's a whole host of psychological tests done about this as well, where somebody in front of you drops 5 pounds. The more money you end up having, the less likely you are to chase the person down and give that money back to them. You know, it's the people with the less money who are the more empathetic and actually are the more fair about certain systems. The studies did show you can reverse this as well, though. You have to reverse it by showing them a film about the disparities and where other things going on in the world that makes you temporarily reset your empathy back to a sort of a level where you are more empathetic. And then after that, you'll be more likely to help someone or give that 5 pounds back or stop for the car. But it won't last.
That's really interesting. And what's concerning as well from it is obviously if you're saying that the wealthier people get, the less empathetic they are. Well, the way our society is built means wealthy people get to the top. To name some good examples, Donald Trump is perfect for this. Lots of money, no real value, just very good at having lots of cash. And you get to the top of society. And actually, having the emotional disconnect and that kind of, I guess I would also say, lack of emotional intelligence more than anything, as you go up is fundamental. And I think this also connects to the kind of the environmental ethics as well. Like, if you don't respect a person, you're not going to respect the planet. You're not going to respect the boundaries and the limits which we have on our natural world.
Yeah. So when we sort of bring it back, there's also another element in my thinking about this. So we are over-consuming. There is a certain segment of the population that really doesn't know any different. And I think that's the hard part. And as a species, I think we are designed to constantly get more stuff, programmed to gather and get more resources. But we haven't evolved, our brains haven't evolved in psychology and behavior to catch up and go, actually, I have enough resources at this point in time. So it's how do we sort of reset that?
Well, I just think there's a point about human beings' relationship with the natural world and the dominion of the natural world and the fact that we are the dominator of the natural world. And I think actually a lot of religion kind of makes out that we are the dominator of the natural world. And it's something which we've actually connected to for millennia now to say, okay, we're powerful over this. But historic religion wasn't like that. But then moving on to today, and I think I might have said this in a previous episode as well, there's some research who's actually said, because we've lost our spirituality generally, and this is all spirituality here, we've kind of looked to consumption as a new form of religion. Well, something that's infinitely growing and something that we can keep doing, keep focusing on, rather than considering kind of the bigger picture and what we're doing. And I think there's also a fundamental question for governments and other states and all sorts of other people to grapple with in terms of how we overcome that and what is a good life for human beings in today's world. Is it just to consume loads of stuff, or is it something more than that?
So essentially, humankind's search for meaning, which used to be filled predominantly by religion back in the day, because human beings weren't as literate and we had to just listen to these people. Now that we don't have that, we're filling it with something else because we don't have an otherwise or overarching North Star to focus our behaviors and patterns on. Yeah.
Yeah. The newest shoes, the newest car, the next thing that we can hold, the tangible asset. Yeah.
Or for me, the next secondhand scarf that I can find. I fully hold my hand up. I probably have 100 scarves. No joke. But I don't need that many scarves. You know, I never did. So there's also another concept that plays into overconsumption, and that is planned obsolescence versus the right to repair. So planned obsolescence, I think maybe many of you have already heard about this, there used to be the washing machine repair person, and you had your washing machine and you had it for like 15, 20 years, and then you would just get one minor part or repair. But as time went on, companies decided that, well, why should we just sell them one part or two parts or three parts over a 20-year period? Where if we stop making some of these parts, they'll have to buy a whole new washing machine, maybe every 7 years, 10 years. And so planned obsolescence is this sort of system where companies decided we're going to stop making certain parts to fix these things and repair these things so that you buy a whole entire new product. Does this sound familiar to you, Tom?
Yeah, and I'm gonna do something unusual here. I'm gonna defend the companies that do it, which I shouldn't do, because they shouldn't do it. It's a terrible thing to do.
You are literally the podcast version of my husband.
But I can see why they do it. Like existing in the economic ecosystem that we all live in today, like if they don't do that, they'll just won't succeed, will they? And it's like a fundamental failure of our systems, and I think the deregulation of our systems that has allowed this. And companies do this because they can and because they have to survive. I know there are companies that are starting to break through the mold now with planned obsolescence. Companies like Fairphone, for example, which have a modular phone, and you can take bits in and you can replace other bits, so you never have to buy a whole new phone. But actually, it's a symptom of a flawed and failing economic system.
But you know, they could still continue to make money because the population's growing, so more households are growing, so they could still be selling washing machines. It's just that they won't be selling a brand new one every time. But yeah, if you have shareholders and your shareholders are constantly demanding higher and higher and higher returns, you know, ever-growing GDP is not the way to go. It's not sustainable.
And I think there's actually something that we as, I know it's something that I took made me ages to get my head around. The idea of like growth year on year, be that a company, be that the whole economy, be that an individual wealth. If you think about like 2% growth a year, which is kind of the low targets that we head for, it's not linear growth. It doesn't, we don't get 2% and it gets to 4% and it gets to 6% after 3 years. It's what we call exponential growth. So it, like, the growth compounds and compounds. So it'll take around about 35 years of growing at 2% to double the amount that is being consumed or being used or for your organization size at that rate. But then it'll only take 70 years to quadruple. And if we come back to the thing we were talking about earlier, material throughput, all of this growth, this compounding and the massive explosion that's required for organizations, the four times in 70 years, the eight times in 100 years, it requires there to be really exploitative and extractive mechanisms to make sure that we do this, because it's not just small bits of growth year on year on year. It's huge scales of growth that's going to be happening over time.
Yeah, and I like that you touched on exploitative, because these exponential growth systems are exploitative, and it's usually the wealthier people that benefit, but it's other countries and poor individuals who suffer the worst consequences of it. And we're literally stealing from the future. We're stealing from actual people today, in my opinion. So this is where I start to get on my high horse and go a bit crazy. So the fact that we're over-consuming is stealing from future generations, full stop. It is.
Because of the race to the bottom culture we've got, which goes on with these organizations, there are around about 16.5 million people in forced or slave labor across the world to give us our fix of consumer demands.
Yeah, to give us our clothing, our tech stuff, our food products. And in fact, there are more people in modern day slavery today than there have been at any other time in all of human history. Granted, that's the population has grown so much, but yeah.
But we are seeing things change with the new laws around things like a right to repair.
Yes, we are. So right to repair is, you know, it's a movement that's been going strong. We've certainly have seen repair rooms come up, repair cafes. We know, you know, gosh, within our own area, the nonprofit that Tom and I volunteer with and do some work with has a free repair room. We also have then everywhere around us, like any town I could throw a rock at now, has a free repair room or a free repair cafe, which I think is great. And these are things that we need to start having more and more of. I also think there's a thing that plays into this, which is also sort of a free library of stuff. Like, you know, we've talked about this before, where if I need a mower for a couple of hours once a week, why can't that mower be shared with seven other houses? But no, we all have to have our own mowers because we all want to mow our lawn when we want, da da da. And there's also some other things that I would like to mention in terms of when you have a baby, people just end up buying and buying more baby clothes. I will say in the UK, I think there is a strong handing down from other family members, baby clothes. But there's a company in one of the Nordic countries. They said, why are we even creating new baby clothes? I mean, the population is growing, so we do have to think about that a bit. So they have a rent baby clothes, and they did it at a price point that is just as good as if you buy new clothes as your child grows. And all you do is you join up, you pop in, you know, the size of your baby, what kind of colors you're looking for, what kind of clothes you're looking for, and they send you the kit. And then when you get to a point, if your kid grows faster or slower than, you know, average, you could certainly send them all back quickly, or you can, you know, have a delay and just keep them longer. But you just send them back when you're ready, and then they send you a new size. And then those clothes just get used, which I think is great, that the same outfit could literally be used by 50 or 60 children, as opposed to just by one child, and then it's sort of kept and tucked away. And it does, you know, make its way around your village. But we are over consuming products, and some for something like a child who grows out of them quite quickly.
That is a really cool scheme. Like a really cool scheme.
It is. And that sort of ties in nicely into another concept, which is circular economy, or sometimes referred to as CE. And that is essentially where you're using resources repeatedly, repairing them, and something stays in circular fashion inside the economy rather than the linear economy that we have now, which is buy something, use it, dispose of it, and it goes to a landfill. Maybe it gets recycled, which is a little bit of circular economy. And in this way, it's more that something gets used, and it, you get, just like what we were talking about with the baby clothes, it gets used and used and used until it can't be used anymore. And then I imagine those clothes from this company, if there's slight rips and tears, that they're mended and passed on to other organizations. It was totally designed as a sustainable business. And so I'm sure they repair their clothes sustainably as well.
Yeah, and I think the circular economy is really picking up as an idea, which is kind of coming to the fore as a really exciting way to transform the way our economy works. And there's lots of concern before about kind of like, what's the impact on jobs? How is this going to impact people's work? But actually, it's also been seen as a way to create jobs as well and be really beneficial. An example of what one of the things that we can kind of see thriving, also not for the music producers, as a move towards a circular economy, something like Spotify, because we're moving away from the material consumption of music through records and CDs to the virtual consumption of it. And that's reducing the amount of actual materials that are required, and therefore the environmental impact. Some other really exciting ideas starting to come through the pipeline at the moment are also the idea of heat as a service. So rather than having a gas boiler in your house, you are looking at how do we buy a unit of heat, and that comes in. So we have a centralized system which requires less materials. We don't all need to have a gas boiler in our house. We don't all need to have the gas pipe works. And if all need to have all of these things going in our houses, and we think about how would we buy a unit of heat from, for example, a district heat network or a centralized ground source heat pump, which tend to be quite expensive, but how can we all collectively buy into this and therefore distribute those benefits across a broad section of people? One that's really exciting, though, is the idea of kind of car batteries as a service as well. So leasing car batteries. And this is something that people are really concerned about, is that, okay, after 4 years, my car battery is only going to be working at 60% capacity. And there's obviously an incentive for car manufacturers today to do that, because that means you buy another battery. But some car manufacturers now are actually saying, okay, how do we lease batteries instead? And actually, we're the owner of that battery, and we make sure it lives for as long as possible. So we will take it off your hands and basically keep it going for as long as needed. And if it goes kaput after a while, it's on the manufacturer rather than the end consumer for the cost of it. So it completely re-engineers the way that actually we think about ownership and consumption. And I think there's a lot of fear about that, because we live in a society which loves the idea of ownership. And I know there are people who would say, I don't want my car battery leased. That's not me owning it. But there are so many things that we already lease. And I think it's an exciting way to be thinking about the future.
Yeah, it's a way of reimagining what the shape of progress and the shape of economy can look like.
And I'd also direct anyone listening to go to the Ellen MacArthur Foundation website, because they're experts in the circular economy and they have such cool resources, and they obviously have an amazing web designer as well, because you flick through the website and you're like, wow, this is so interactive and fun. It's like you're in a museum online.
So we've come to the point in the podcast where we do our quiz. Are you ready, Tom, for your overconsumption quiz?
I'm not sure, but I'm going to try my best.
All right. On any given day, what is the percentage of population of people that eat at a fast food restaurant? And this does play into overconsumption. 5%, 25%, 40%. 55%.
I'm trying to work out how many takeaways I get. Let's have some hope in society and humanity. I'm going to go 10%. I feel like I should be more optimistic.
Sadly, your optimism, not doing any favors. For the next few questions, you may want to switch over to pessimistic Tom. So it's 40%.
No!
Yeah, eat at a fast food restaurant on any given day. Next question. Now, this plays into fast food. Because of our global overconsumption of animal products and the population, and also food waste and how much we're eating all these foods, what percentage of farmed animals now live on factory farms? 25%, 50%, 65%, 99%?
That's really depressing. Negative Nelly hat on says 99%, but I really hope that's wrong.
The negative played well for you. 99% of farmed animals are now living on factory farms. So, and of course, we know this plays into overconsumption for a variety of reasons, particularly with antibiotics that are needed to deal with those issues, energy, water, and such.
God, we haven't even talked about the antibiotic crisis, yeah.
Gosh, yeah, no. All right. Next question. In the United States, how many tons of clothing are thrown away each year? 5 million, 10 million, 14 million, 23 million.
I'll be negative again then, 23 million.
It's 14.
Oh, you've thrown me off the ball now.
Yeah, but that still is just ridiculous. 14 million tons. That's not even like 14 million pieces. It's 14 million tons of clothing thrown away each year. A good rule of thumb is whenever buying a piece of clothing, ask yourself, will you wear this 30 times? Or in the case of one of my favorite turtlenecks, that's going to be 300.
Do you ask that question from me by a scarf, PK?
Well, yeah, I do tend to have specific ones I wear over and over again.
Impulse scarf buys.
I am an impulse scarf buyer, but I will say, everyone, they are secondhand, zero carbon emissions for my scarf habit. But that does impact my cabinet habit. Next question. So we've talked about fast fashion before. We talk about the waste, but we don't necessarily always talk about the amount of money that is wasted. So how much money is estimated wasted a year by the clothing industry? 100 million. These are big numbers, Tom. 250 million. 1 billion. 500 billion.
It's got to be 500 billion.
And you are right. Related to that, I'll give you a fact. 20% of the wastewater in our world is tied to clothing manufacturing factories. If you've got closets bursting, then, you know, maybe just leave them as is. Definitely there are some people that do need to buy more clothing because they don't actually have enough, or as they get to have higher income, they can, you know, buy better quality and sort of replace the stuff that they've needed. But for most of us, we have plenty of clothing. By the way, all the stats that went with the quiz are from the Impact Investor.
Just to clarify as well, I have just Googled the figure because I'm fairly sure this was around about the same amount. that actually, if that money was put to solving world hunger, it would solve world hunger every year.
Wow.
Just a quick side note here, which is really interesting that you might find interesting and some of our listeners might find interesting. There's some really cool work going on in North Staffordshire, which is where we're based. Actually looking at the River Churn, which is a river up there, looking at the textiles industry over time and the impact that that's had on the waterways up there, and looking at the long-term impact of the fashion industry historically, and actually what that'll mean for global ecosystems as well. So how in places like India and Pakistan, where a lot of the manufacturing is going on at the moment, how in 100 years time, like in Leek at the moment where this is, there's still repercussions from the fashion industry, and how we can still expect that in places across the world as well.
Really? I'm depressed. So we just want to mention one more thing that doesn't really have anything to do with overconsumption, and that is it is May, and there is a great campaign called No Mo May. And that's because if you let your lawns grow and let all those wildflowers come up, it is so, so delicious. It's a fantastic buffet for the bees and our other pollinators, which is really, really in need. So participate in No Mo May, and you can also Google it and find out all kinds of interesting facts.
I'm so excited for round two of my No Mo May, because the first time that we lived in this house, the previous owners had put loads of stuff on the grass, so I only got grass. This year, we've got little things starting to emerge through after a year of not putting all the pesticides down. We've got some dandelions popping up, a few little cleavers coming through.
Oh, it'd be nice. And you should do a little video. I had my neighbor ask me, how are you going to keep your dandelions from coming up? Because I had let it go pretty badly. And I said, I'm not going to do anything. I said, our bees need that. And also, if you live in Staffordshire County, England, the Staffordshire County Council is giving away free No Mow May signs. So that way you can put one up in your lawn so your neighbors understand why you're not mowing. And maybe that might also encourage other people to do the same. Thanks for listening. And if you like what you've heard and you listen on Apple, then please do leave us a review.
And if you've got any other thoughts on any of the topics we've discussed today, please email us at hello@theecocentrics.com.
Or you can look us up on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn, and now on TikTok as well.
And make sure to hit follow so you never miss an episode. Never miss an episode. You've got Somerset in me again.
See you next week when we'll be discussing the impacts of marketing on climate and overconsumption.
Bye.
Ciao. The Ecocentrics is produced by Emma Newman.
Theme and quiz music produced by Morgan Bryan.
And if you've been wondering how we're funded by all the money PK saves with her 100 scarves.